Congressman John R. Lewis died Friday, July 17, 2020. His death was a somber event for our nation, yet it brought back the memory of a joyous event for us at Concord Carlisle High School. On November 5, 2001, Congressman Lewis delivered a speech in an all-school assembly at our school. In his younger days, the 1950s and 60s, Congressman Lewis had been a frontline participant in the civil rights movement and the president of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, popularly known as SNCC, S-N-C-C, which fought to gain racial equality, legislative justice, and greater economic opportunities in the nation. The social activism of today, 2020, and the present Black Lives Matter initiatives can be favorably compared to the efforts of SNCC, led by John R. Lewis, and others in the 1960s. For the past 30-plus years, Congressman Lewis has taken his activism to the United States Congress and served as a representative from Georgia. In the U.S. Congress, he transferred his social activism into legislative policymaking as he continued his work to broaden and secure social justice access for U.S. citizens. It was a great event for us when he spoke that day, almost 20 years ago. He spoke of the major events in his life up until that point, and the need for the nation to continue to seek liberty and justice for all. After you listen to the ceremony and Congressman Lewis deliver his words from that day, you may want to read his autobiography entitled Walking with the Wind, a memoir of the movement.
I hope all of the students in the audience really have an appreciation how special this day is. It truly is a special day for Concord Carlisle High School. I have a very small role, mostly to welcome everybody here. I want to welcome the students, and I hope you will be listening closely and remembering this for many years to come. I also have the privilege of welcoming a number of special guests. We have representatives from the school committee. We have representatives from the selectmen, from the finance committee. We have Congresswoman Fargo. We have Superintendent Mavrages, Assistant Superintendent Binkley. But one of our special guests is more special than any other. Congressman Lewis, of course. But I'm speaking of someone even more special. Mr. Chico has come back to visit us for today. I'm really proud of that. Yeah. And that shows you how special today really is. One of the things I want you all to understand is that Mr. Zellner has worked very, very hard for almost a year to make sure that this event was organized properly, arranged, and Mr. Zellner is really the one to receive the credit for us having Congressman Lewis come to speak to us. So I'm going to hand over the program to Mr. Zellner.
Ujambo, mabibi na mabwana, uhaligani. Some of you know what I said. Thank you, Principal DeLong. And greetings to you, the students of the classes of 02, 03, 04, and 05. Welcome to this assembly. You have a unique privilege. While I know that most of you do not have the choice not to be here, today's speaker will enhance all of your classroom activities the rest of this day and make you glad that you were here. Firstly, I want to recognize and thank the Rutgers family, whose foresight and generosity have made this assembly and other educational opportunities possible for our students. We remember the children of the family, those who have graduated within the past decade and have gone on to other portions and parts of their life. They were excellent students, excellent people, and they make us, their teachers, proud to say that we taught them. The high school community extends greetings to our superintendent, Ed Mavrages, and Assistant Superintendent Nadine Binkley, our past principal, Elaine DeChico, our staff and other faculty members from the high school and other town offices in Concord, our town officials, our elected state officials, our other invited guest, and Representative Congressman Marty Meehan, our congressman from Massachusetts 5th District. We especially recognize, and most significantly, we are privileged, very privileged, to hear Congressman John Lewis this morning. At this time, I would like to recognize Congressman Marty Meehan, our 5th District representative. He is the ranking member, a senior member, excuse me, on the House Judiciary Committee and the House Armed Services Committee. He has worked with John Lewis and in support of civil rights events and activities. And we especially want to recognize the work that the House Judiciary and the House Armed Services Committee are doing under the leadership of Congressman Meehan in terms of our response, the response of the United States to the events of September 11th, both in Washington, D.C., in New York City, and in suburban Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. So at this time, would you welcome Congressman Marty Meehan?
Thank you. Thank you very much, and good morning. It's great to be back to Concord-Carlisle High School. I was here and spoke to a number of you about 2 weeks ago, and we talked about the tragedy of September 11th. I'm not going to speak very long today, but I have to tell you, I was pretty impressed when as soon as I came into the gymnasium, somebody came up to me and said, you know, when you were here, you talked about the issue of airline security and how we're going to make sure that people who fly airplanes in the United States are safe. And I noticed that the House passed one bill and the Senate passed another bill. What's your position on the House and the Senate bill? And I was very impressed to hear this same student had watched Senator Kerry on Meet the Press yesterday. So as I was telling Congressman John Lewis as we walked in, you always have to be on your toes when you come to Concord-Carlisle because they're watching everything that's happening. But I was glad the student mentioned it because the fact is, I think the House made a serious mistake. We talked about September 11th and we talked about the challenges that our country faces to try to make the American people as safe and secure as possible. The United States Senate passed a bill 100-0 to federalize airport safety in America and have it come under the Justice Department and make sure that federal law enforcement were there at airports all across America to protect people that are flying. The leadership in the House of Representatives took a different view. They took the view that we can keep the present system in place private people at airports. They would have come under federal supervision, but we still would have these private companies in charge of airport security. And I'm opposed to that. I know that John Lewis voted against that as well, because we believe that a priority in this country to keep the economy strong, but more importantly to keep our people safe, must be protection of people as they're flying, the safety of people. And I believe the Senate bill, a bipartisan Senate bill, does a much better job at it. From here, it goes to what's called a conference committee. I'm hopeful at the end of the negotiations between the House and the Senate that we'll get an airport security bill that looks a lot similar to the Senate bill than the bill that I voted against and John Lewis voted against in the House. Both of us voted for the Senate bill to federalize airport security, make it a law enforcement function. I'm delighted to be back here, also delighted to be here with John Lewis. As I told many of you who were there, being a member of Congress can be a pretty exciting job. You get an opportunity sometimes to meet leaders of foreign countries, to meet and work with the President of the United States. I've met and worked with President Bush. I've worked with President Clinton. You get to meet leaders from all over the country and all over the world. It's a very exciting job. But of all the people that I've met in the Congress of the United States, I have never been more excited to work with and meet and listen to John Lewis. He is a person who is not only a distinguished member of the Congress, but was very involved in writing the history of civil rights in this country. and I had an opportunity recently to be in Memphis, Tennessee with John Lewis as we toured with Representative Harold Ford, as we toured the Civil Rights Museum. And I cannot think of any period of time where I've been a member of Congress that was more moving, more inspiring than as we sat out at and stood out at the balcony of the Lorraine Motel. It is now part of the museum where Dr. King was shot and killed in April of 1968, as we held hands and said a prayer for Dr. King and said a prayer for our country. How inspired and moving it was to be there and to have that experience. John Lewis is a great member of Congress. As many of you, I'm sure, have done your reading and your reading of history, was a freedom rider in the South. He was a person who led 600 marches on March 7th, 1965, across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, trying to fight for what we consider today a right of everyone, the right to vote, the right to not have discrimination when you cast your ballot. And as John Lewis led that march across the Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, the country watched as there were police officers and state police troopers who prevented them, attempted to prevent them through violence. And the whole nation watched that, and it changed the course of American history. It was one of the reasons why we were able to get a Civil Rights Act and a Voting Act passed through the Congress. You know, Dr. King wrote a book late in his life, Where Do We Go From Here? And it's kind of the motto of the Civil Rights Museum. Dr. King felt that it wasn't over in 1963 in the March on Washington. He felt that it wasn't over when the Civil Rights Act was passed and the Voting Rights was passed. He was moving forward to speak out against the war in Vietnam and moving forward to try to end discrimination, and had actually gone to support a sanitation workers' strike in Memphis. And I think John Lewis certainly accomplished great things as a freedom rider in leading the march across the Pettus Bridge, but he didn't believe that his work was over. He's one of the outstanding members of Congress fighting for economic justice day in and day out. So when people ask me, who are the great, really great people you meet as a member of Congress, I have to tell you, there is no greater person that I have met than John Lewis, and I'm delighted to be here with all of you, and like you, looking forward to hear the great words from John Lewis. So thank you for inviting me back. Thank you for following the issues that confront our country, and keep following them, because democracy only works when people like you are following the activities and speaking out for what is right and what is just. Thank you for inviting me.
Our guest and speaker this morning needs no introduction, but I'll give him one anyway, because I know that there are some of us for whom the name John Lewis is about as innocuous as the name John Smith. Please pay attention this morning when John Lewis speaks. There will be a test afterwards. No, not a pencil and paper test, but I promise that you will well remember where you were when you first met John Lewis. I first met John Lewis 34 years ago. I met John Lewis as I was reading and writing in a graduation thesis I was preparing entitled A Case for Civil Disobedience. In my research, I read writings from Henry Thoreau, from David Walker, from Thomas Jefferson, from Franz Fanon, and many others. But it was in a writing by Howard Zinn that I first met John Lewis. I met John Lewis, but John Lewis did not meet me until about an hour ago. You see, I was only reading about John Lewis. John Lewis on the Freedom Ride. John Lewis leading student sit-ins in Nashville in 1960. John Lewis at the March on Washington. John Lewis is chairman of the Student Nonviolent Committee. Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. John Lewis demonstrating for voters' rights in Selma, Alabama. And John Lewis, and John Lewis, and John Lewis. This man was something else. Who is John Lewis? I quickly found out, and to paraphrase the words from one of my former students here at CCHS, how come I never heard about him before? For me, the opportunity to complete my research was the opportunity for John Lewis to meet me. I have hoped for and anticipated that opportunity for more than 30 years. This morning, you and I have the opportunity to meet John Lewis. And when we meet him, we meet one who manifests the many aspects of what we have come to call the American dream. While that dream is interpreted differently by each citizen of the United States, aspects of John Lewis's life can be seen in all of those interpretations. In his life, John Lewis has chosen to seek the moral high ground. He has entered in at the straight gate. He has chosen to walk a challenging and narrow path, a very public path, and in a very bright light. He has chosen to create and participate in the beloved community and to strive to see the United States live out the true meaning of its creed. John Lewis has known kings and presidents, Addie Mays and Willie Boys, Sheriff Clarks, Mayor Pickett's, and Parchman Prisons. He has kept the faith. He is finishing the course. We are walking with the wind. And John Lewis is here to speak to us. Please listen and take notes. Students, please welcome the Honorable Congressman John Robert Lewis.
Thank you, sir.
Mrs. Elner, thank you very much for those kind words of introduction. Thank you for inviting me to be here. Marty Min, my friend, my colleague, my brother, thank you also for those kind words. And let me say to the people in your district, they're more than lucky. They're very blessed to have you as their congressperson. Thank you very much. Let me say to the principal, the assistant principal, former principal, the superintendent, all of the elected officials, and a dear friend of mine that I have not seen in a few years, State Representative Atkins, thank all of you for being here, those on the school board, everybody, thank you for being here. And to you wonderful, smart, gifted students, the leaders of the 21st century. I'm happy to see each and every one of you. Let me just begin by saying, Mrs. Elner didn't tell you that I didn't grow up in a big city like Concord. I didn't grow up in a big city like Lexington. I didn't grow up in a big city like Springfield or Newton. I didn't grow up in a big city like Cambridge. I didn't grow up in a big city like Boston. I grew up on a farm 50 miles from Montgomery in southeast Alabama near a little place called Troy. My father was a sharecropper, a tenant farmer. But back in 1944, when I was 4 years old, and I do remember when I was four. How many of you remember when you was four? Oh, you don't remember when you was four. But I remember when I was 4 years old. In 1944, my father had saved $300. And with the $300, he bought 110 acres of land. It's a lot of land for $300. My 87-year-old mother is still living on this land. On this farm, we raise a lot of cotton, corn, peanuts, hogs, cows, and chickens. Now, if some of you just happen to come to Washington to visit congressmen in and happened to stop by my office, the first thing the staff will offer you will be a Coca-Cola, because Atlanta happened to be the home of the Coca-Cola Bottling Company. And Coca-Cola provide all members of the Georgia Congressional Delegation with an adequate supply of Coca-Cola products to be made available to our visitors. The next thing the staff will offer you would be some peanuts, because we raise a lot of peanuts in Georgia. And the Georgia Peanut Commission provide us all with peanuts. I don't eat too many of those peanuts. I ate so many peanuts when I was growing up in rural Alabama, I just don't want to see any more peanuts. I used to get on a flight and fly from Atlanta to Washington or Washington back to Atlanta, and the flight attendant would try to push some peanuts on me. And I said, no, thank you. Don't care for any peanuts. But you also heard me say that on this farm, we raise a lot of chickens. I know here at this great high school, you're very smart. You have wonderful teachers. You're smart. Some of you are doing so well in math and science, in history and literature. Some of you have mastered the computers. You're very smart, but you don't know anything about raising chickens. Anyone in here know anything about raising chickens? Oh, well, okay. But let me tell you what I had to do as a young boy growing up in rural Alabama during the 40s and the 50s. I had to take the fresh eggs, mark them with a pencil, place them under the setting hen, and wait for 3 long weeks for the little chicks to hatch. Now, some smart teacher, or maybe some smart student, said, John Lewis, why do you mark those fresh eggs with a pencil before you place them under the setting hen? Well, from time to time, another hen would get on the same nest, and there would be some more eggs. And you had to be able to tell the fresh eggs from the eggs that were already under the setting hen. Do you follow me? Oh, you follow me. Good. When these little chicks were hatched, I would fool these setting hens. I would cheat on these setting hens. I would take these little chicks and give them to another hen. I'll put them in a box with a lantern. Raise them on their own. Get some more fresh eggs. Mark them with a pencil. Place them under the setting hen. Encourage the setting hen to stay in the nest for another 3 weeks. When I look back on it, when I kept on cheating on these setting hens, and when I really think about it, it was not the right thing to do. It was not the moral thing to do. It was not the most loving thing to do. It was not the most nonviolent thing to do, to cheat on these setting hens, but I kept doing it. I was never quite able to save $18.98 to order the most inexpensive incubator from the Sizzlin' Roebuck store in Atlanta, so I kept on cheating on these setting hens. Well, as a little boy, I wanted to be a minister. One of my uncles had Santa Claus to bring me a Bible and learn to read the Bible. But I kept on wishing that I could get an incubator, a hatcher. We used to get the Sizzlin' Roebuck catalog. Most of you are too young to remember. It was a big book, thick book. Maybe your parents or some of your teachers would remember, grandparents. We call it the wish book. I wish I had this. I wish I had that. So when my uncle brought me this Bible, and I started teaching or preaching. From time to time, we would gather all of our chickens together in the chicken house, like you would gather here in this auditorium. With my sisters and brothers, along with the chickens, they would make up the congregation. And I would start speaking or preaching. And as I started, these chickens would become very quiet. And when I look back on it, some of these chickens would bow their heads. Some of these chickens would shake their heads. They never quite said amen. But Marty, I'm convinced that some of these chickens that I preached in the 40s and in the 50s tended to listen to me better than some of our colleagues listened to me today in the Congress. And some of these chickens were a little more productive. At least they produce eggs. Growing up there in rural Alabama, when we would visit the little town of Troy, visit Montgomery, visit Birmingham, I saw those signs that said white men, colored men. I saw those signs that said white women, colored women. I saw those signs that said white waiting, colored waiting. As a young child, I tasted the bitter fruits of segregation and racial discrimination. In 1955, at the age of 15, I heard of Rosa Parks. I heard of Martin Luther King Jr. In 1956, at the age of 16, along with a few of my brothers and sisters and some of my first cousins, we went down to the public library in Troy, Alabama, 10 miles from our home, trying to get a library card, trying to check out some books. And we were told by the librarian that the library was for whites only and not for colored. But on July 5th, 1998, I went back to the Pike County Public Library in Troy, Alabama, for a book signing. And hundreds of black and white citizens showed up, and they gave me a library card. It says something about the distance that we've come, the progress that we've made in America, toward laying down the burden of race. When I was 17, about the age of many of you here, in 1957, finished high school. I wanted to attend a little college called Troy State College. It is now known as Troy State University, short distance from my house, from my home where I grew up. Filed my application, had my high school transcript sent there. I never heard a word from the school. It didn't admit black students. So I wrote a letter to Martin Luther King Jr. I didn't tell my mother, my father, any of my sisters or brothers that I was writing a letter to Dr. King. I told him of my desire to attend Troy State. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote me back and sent me a round-trip Greyhound bus ticket and invited me to come to Montgomery to visit with him. In the meantime, I had applied to study at a little college in Nashville, Tennessee, and I will never forget it as long as I live. An uncle of mine gave me a footlocker and a $100 bill before I left to go to school. I put everything that I own, my few books, my clothing, everything except those chickens in that footlocker, and went off to school in Nashville. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. got back in touch and suggested when I was home for spring break to come to see him. In March of 1958, by this time, I'm 18 years old, on a Saturday morning, my father drove me to the Greyhound bus station, I boarded the bus, and traveled the 50 miles from Troy, Alabama, to Montgomery. Met there by a young lawyer at the Greyhound bus station in Montgomery, who drove me to the First Baptist Church in downtown Montgomery, pastor by the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, leader of the local movement, a friend of Dr. King, and ushered me into the office of the church. I walked through the doors. I was so scared. I didn't know what I was going to say to Dr. King. I saw Martin Luther King Jr. and Reverend Ralph Abernathy standing behind a desk. And Dr. King said, "Are you John Lewis? Are you the boy from Troy?" And I spoke up and said, "Dr. King, I am John Robert Lewis." I gave my whole name. I didn't want there to be any mistake that I was the right person. That was the beginning of my involvement in the civil rights movement. As a student, I continued to study in Nashville. But we studied the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. We studied Thoreau and civil disobedience. We studied the great religions of the world. And we started sitting in, black and white college students, high school students, at segregated lunch counters and restaurants in downtown Nashville. While we would be sitting in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion, someone would come up and put a lighted cigarette out in our hair or down our backs, pour hot water on us, hot coffee, hot chocolate. But we didn't strike back. Many of us accepted nonviolence not simply as a technique or as a tactic, but as a way of life, as a way of living. We came to the conclusion that the way of love, that the way of nonviolence, the way of peace is a better way. It is a more excellent way. We came to the conclusion that means and ends are inseparable. We accepted this idea of the beloved community. the good society, the all-inclusive community. From there, many of us got involved in something called the Freedom Ride. Just think, a few short years ago, it would have been impossible for blacks and whites to ride together on a Greyhound bus or Trailway bus, to sit in the same waiting room, to ride together in a taxi cab in Virginia, in North Carolina, in South Carolina, in Alabama, in Georgia, in Mississippi. So we went on the Freedom Ride to desegregate places of public transportation. We were arrested. At times we were beaten and we were jailed. But all across the South, people kept standing up and fighting for what they believed in. And then, in June of 1963, I became the head of an organization better known as SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, 38 years ago, when I moved from Nashville to Atlanta, where the organization was headed, and we shared an office with Martin Luther King Jr. 7 days after becoming the head of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, I found myself in a meeting with Roy Wilkins of the NAACP, Whitney Young of the Urban League, James Former of CORE, A. Philip Randolph, the labor leader, and Martin Luther King Jr. in the Oval Office with President Kennedy. It was my first time meeting President Kennedy. And it was in that meeting on June 21st, 1963, that A. Philip Randolph said to President Kennedy, he said, "Mr. President, the masses are restless, and we're going to march on Washington." You can tell by the very body language of President Kennedy, he didn't like what he heard. And he said, "Mr. Randolph, if you bring all these people to Washington, won't there be disorder? Won't there be violence?" And Mr. Randolph responded and said, "Mr. President, this will be an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent protest." We left that meeting with President Kennedy. He came out on the lawn of the White House and announced to the media that we had a wonderful meeting with the president and we would be organizing a massive march on Washington. Between June 21st and August 28, 1963, we mobilized the American community and more than 250,000 citizens all over our country came to Washington, and they heard Martin Luther King Jr. deliver that magnificent speech, "I Have a Dream." I was 23 years old, had all of my hair, and I was a few pounds lighter, and I was the youngest speaker. When I was working on my speech, I had been reading a copy of the New York Times, and I saw a photograph of a group of women in Southern Africa, carrying signs saying, "One person, one vote." So in my March on Washington speech, I said something like, "One man, one vote is the African cry. It is ours too, it must be ours." That became sort of the slogan for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And we turned our attention to trying to get people registered to vote in 11 states. Or the old South, the old Confederacy, from Virginia to Texas. A few weeks, less than a month after the March on Washington, when we got back into the heart of the South, on September 15th, 1963, it was a terrible bombing of a little church in Birmingham, Alabama, the 16th Street Baptist Church that had been used for the meeting place for nonviolent protesters. Four little girls attending Sunday school were killed that Sunday morning. That was a very sad and dark moment for the civil rights movement. But it made us more determined than ever before to stand up and fight for the right to vote. We intensified our efforts in Alabama, in Mississippi, and other parts of the South. We started organizing something called the Mississippi Summer Project. We launched a campaign in Selma, Alabama. And a few weeks later, the terrible news of November 22nd, 1963, after President Kennedy had been assassinated. It was another dark hour for the nation, for the world, and for those of us in the civil rights movement who saw President Kennedy, his brother Robert Kennedy, and the federal government as a sympathetic referee in the struggle for civil rights. But we didn't give up. We went all across the country recruiting people to come to Mississippi to work that summer. More than 1,000 young people, college students, teachers, lawyers, priests, rabbis, ministers, nuns, and others came to Mississippi to work that summer. In Mississippi, that state had a black voting age population of more than 450,000, and only about 16,000 blacks were registered to vote. You had to pass a so-called literacy test, be able to interpret certain section of the Constitution of the United States, a certain section of the Constitution of Mississippi. There were black men and women teaching in our public schools, professors at colleges and universities, black doctors and black lawyers, people with undergraduate degrees, master, doctor degrees, being told they could not read or write well enough. On one occasion, there was a black man who had a PhD degree in philosophical theology, and he flunked a so-called literacy test. On another occasion, a man was asked to give the number of bubbles in a bar of soap. How many students at Concord Carlisle High School can give the number of bubbles in a bar of soap? That whole effort came to a head on June 21st, 1964, when three young men that I knew, Andy Goodman, Mickey Schreiner, white, James Shaney, black, went out to investigate the burning of a black church that had been used for voter registration workshop. These three young men were stopped by the sheriff in their car, arrested, taken to jail by the sheriff. Later that same Sunday night, they were taken from the jail by the sheriff and his deputy, turned over to the Klan, where they were beaten, shot, and killed. These three young men didn't die in Vietnam. They didn't die in the Middle East. They didn't die in Africa. They didn't die in Eastern Europe. They died here in our own country for the right of all of our citizens to become participants in a democratic process, for all of our citizens to be able to register and vote. President Johnson won a landslide election after signing the Civil Rights Act in 1964. In December 1964, Martin Luther King Jr., this wonderful, unbelievable human being that I got to know, was my friend, my big brother, came back to America after receiving the Nobel Peace Prize, had a meeting with President Johnson at the White House and said, "Mr. President, we need a strong voting rights act." And President Johnson said to Dr. King in so many words, "We don't have the votes in the Congress to get a voting rights act passed. I just signed the Civil Rights Act." Martin Luther King Jr. came back to Atlanta, met with people in his own organization, met with those of us in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and he said we would write that act. And he made a decision to join us in Selma, Alabama, where we have been involved since 1962. There was one county, one political subdivision between Selma and Montgomery, Lowndes County, in the heart of the Black Belt of Alabama, that was more than 80% African American, but there was not a single registered African-American voter in the county. In Selma, Alabama, only 2.1% of blacks of voting age were registered to vote. You can only attempt to register on the first and third Mondays of each month. And the only place you could attempt to register was at the county courthouse. You had a sheriff there who was a very big man, tall, mean. He wore a gun on one side, a nightstick on the other side. He carried an electric cow prodder in his hand, and he didn't use it on cows. He wore a button on his left lapel that said never. Never to voter registration, never to integration. When it was my day to lead a group of elderly black men and women downtown Selma to the courthouse to get up the steps inside the door to try to get an application form to pass the so-called literacy test, Sheriff Clark met me at the top of the steps. And he said, John Lewis, you're not side agitator. You're the lowest form of humanity. I looked the sheriff straight in the eye, and I said, Sheriff, I may be an agitator, but I'm not an outsider. I grew up only 90 miles from here. We're going to stay here until these people allow to register to vote. And he said, you're under arrest, and he arrested me, along with a few other people, and took us to jail. A few days later, Martin Luther King Jr. and others came to Selma. More than 300 people arrested in one day. We filled the little jail of Selma. And then about 2 weeks later, in a little town called Marion, Alabama, Perry County, the home county of Mrs. Martin Luther King Jr., Mrs. Ralph Abernathy, and the late Mrs. Andrew Young, Jean Young, there was a march for the right to vote. A confrontation occurred that evening. A young man was shot in the stomach by a state trooper by the name of Jimmie Lee Jackson. And because of what happened to him, we made a decision, the movement did, that we will march from Selma to Montgomery. It was Sunday, March 7th, beautiful Sunday afternoon. We conducted a nonviolent workshop. 600 of us lined up in twos to walk in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion, 50 miles from Selma to Montgomery, the capital of the state of Alabama. I was walking beside a young man by the name of Jose Williams from Dr. King's organization. I was wearing a backpack before it became fashionable to wear backpacks. And in this backpack, I had two books, an apple, an orange, toothbrush, and toothpaste. I thought we were going to get arrested and that we were going to go to jail. So I wanted to have something to read, something to eat. And since I was going to be in close quarters with my friends, colleagues, and neighbors, I wanted to be able to brush my teeth. We get to the edge of the bridge crossing the Alabama River, the Edmund Pettus Bridge. We looked down below, we saw all of this water. Jose Williams said to me, John, can you swim? I said, no. I said, Jose, can you swim? And he said, no. I said, well, that's too much water down there. We're not going to jump, and we're not going back. We're going forward. And we continued to walk in an orderly fashion, almost complete silence. We get to the apex of the bridge, and down below we see a sea of blue, Alabama state troopers. And behind the state troopers, you saw Sheriff Clark deputies, members of his posse, saw men on horseback. We continue to walk. We come within hearing distance of the state troopers. And a man identified himself and said, I'm Major John Cloud of the Alabama state troopers. This is an unlawful march and will not be allowed to continue. I give you 3 minutes to disperse and return to your church. In less than a minute and a half, Major John Cloud said, troopers advance. You saw these men putting on their gas masks. They came toward us, beating us with nightsticks and bullwhips, tramping us with horses, releasing their tear gas. I was hit in the head by a state trooper with a nightstick and had a concussion at the bridge. I thought I was going to die. I thought I saw death. To this day, I don't know how I made it back across that bridge through the streets of Selma, back to a little church called Brown Chapel AME Church that we had left from. But I do recall being back at the church that Sunday afternoon. By this time, the church is full to capacity. More than 2,000 people on the outside trying to get in to protest what had happened on the bridge. And someone asked me to say something to the audience. And I stood up and said, I don't understand it. President Johnson can send troops to Vietnam. but cannot send troops to Selma, Alabama, to protect people who only desire to register to vote. The next thing I knew, I had been admitted to the Good Samaritan Hospital there in Selma. Early the next morning, Martin Luther King Jr. and Reverend Abernathy traveled from Atlanta to Selma, came by to visit me. And Dr. King said, "Don't worry, John. We will make it from Selma to Montgomery, and the voting rights will be passed." He was right. He issued a call for religious leaders to come to Selma. And more than 1,000 ministers, priests, rabbis, nuns, and others came to Selma. Many from this state. And one young man from Boston by the name of Reverend Joe Reed came there and marched across that bridge on March 9th. Later that night, he was attacked, returning from dinner, by members of the Klan. He was beaten so severely, he died 2 days later at a local hospital in Birmingham, Alabama. But we didn't give up. President Johnson went before the Congress on March 15th, 1965, and made one of the most moving speeches any American president had made in modern time on the whole question of voting rights. He started that speech off that night by saying, "I speak tonight for the dignity of man and for the destiny of democracy." He went on to say, "At time, history and fate meet in a single place, and man unending search for freedom." So it was more than a century ago at Lexington and at Concord. So it was at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama. He introduced the Voting Rights Act, condemned the violence in Selma, and in that speech he said over and over again, "And we shall overcome." I was standing next to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He started crying. Tears came down his face. We all cried a little. But we knew it was just a matter of time that Congress passed the Voting Rights Act and the president signed it into law on August 6, 1965. So I said to you young people, as students, as leaders of the 21st century, because of the civil rights movement, because of the action of the Congress, the action of men like President Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, because of the involvement of hundreds and thousands of our citizens, we have witnessed a nonviolent revolution in America when it comes to the question of race. We live in a better country. We live in a much better society. So I said to all of you, you must never ever give up or give in or give out. You must keep the faith. I got arrested 40 times, beaten and left lying unconscious at the Greyhound bus station in Montgomery in May of 1961, concussion at the bridge in Selma in 1965. But I didn't give up, and you must not give up. If someone had told me when I was preaching to those chickens, if someone had told me when I was marching with Martin Luther King Jr., that one day I would be in the Congress, in the House of Representatives, serving with your congressperson, Marty Mann, I would say, "You're crazy, you don't know what you're talking about." So don't give up. Don't get lost in a sea of despair. Hold on to your dreams. Do what you can to make our society, our country, our world a better place. I'm going to close. I know these are hard and difficult times for many of us. We don't quite understand what happened on September the 11th. But we have to say, people may bomb our buildings, kill some of our fellow citizens, but they will never, ever kill our love for freedom and our commitment to a just and open society. When I was growing up outside of Troy, Alabama, 50 miles from Montgomery, when I was only about 4.5 or 5 years old, I remember it like it was yesterday. I had an aunt by the name of Seneva. And my aunt Seneva lived in what we call a shotgun house. I know here at Concord Carlisle High School, you never seen a shotgun house, have you? You never seen one. You don't know what it looked like, right? But my Aunt Suniva lived in a shotgun house. She didn't have a green manicured lawn. She had a simple, plain dirt yard. And sometime at night, you can look up through the ceiling, through the tin roof of this old house, and count the stars. When it would rain, she would go out and get a pail of what we call a bucket and catch the rainwater. From time to time, she would go out into the woods and take branches from a dogwood tree and make a broom. And she called that broom the brush broom. And she would sweep this dirt yard very clean, sometimes 2 and 3 times a week. For those of you who are so young, probably never travel in the rural South. Let me tell you what a shotgun house is. In a nonviolent sense, a shotgun house is an old house with a tin roof where you can bounce a ball through the front door and it will go straight out the back door. My Aunt Suniva lived in a shotgun house. Well, one Saturday morning, a group of us, a few of my sisters and brothers and a few of my first cousins, about 12 or 15 of us young children, were playing in my Aunt Suniva dirt yard. And an unbelievable storm came up. The wind started blowing, the thunder started rolling, the lightning started flashing, and the rain started beating on the timber of the old shotgun house. Mom became terrified. She started crying. She thought this old house was going to blow away. She got us all on the inside and told us to hold hands. And as little children, we did as we were told. We all started crying. The thunder continued to roll. The lightning continued to flash. The rain continued to beat on this old house. The wind continued to blow. And when one corner of this old house appeared to be lifting from its foundation, my aunt had us to walk to that corner to try to hold the house down with our little bodies. When the other corner appeared to be lifting, she had us to walk to that corner to try to hold this house down. We were little children walking with the wind, but we never, ever left the house. As students, as citizens of America, as citizens of the world, as leaders of the 21st century, you must never, ever leave the house. The house of Concord Carlisle. The house of America, the house of the world. We all live in one house. Just maybe our foremothers and our forefathers all came to this great country in different ships. But we all are in the same boat now. It doesn't matter whether we are black or white, whether we are Hispanic, Asian American, or Native American. We all live in one house. So stay with the house. Walk with the wind. And let the spirit of Concord Carlisle be your guide. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Congressman. Thank you, Congressman. And for students of CCHS, thank you, Congressman. The clock is not our ally, but I'll just take 30 seconds to comment to the constituents in the 5th District in Georgia who have Congressman Lewis as their representative, and to us here, as we do extend that metaphor, let us all remember that we are walking with the wind. And again, thank you, Congressman. We normally have a 5-minute passing time. I'll usurp, I guess, a little authority here I have the microphone. I'll give us 6 minutes. We're on our way to D block. Thank you. You are dismissed.